Well, I'm standing beside the woman that started a lot of this questioning, and I'm so pleased to be. It's Linda Nochlin, who is a professor of modern art at the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University. And I just want to say a couple things. I hope that after the Linda's talk, we'll have time for some more questions. And David Little from the Education Department thought it would be good to mention the fact that in 2008, in the spring, there'll be a graduate student symposium. We've been having those at MoMA now annually. And the 2008 subject is gender and art. So all those of you who are graduate students now and want to write some papers and submit them, we'd love to see them. Okay, Linda, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to be speaking today, and I thank all the people that I'm thankful toward, I guess. And I will start by saying that I speak as an old feminist, although I refuse to identify totally with that position. And I also speak not as a perfect feminist, but rather, to borrow Winnicott's unforgettable phrase, as a good enough feminist. That's what I feel I am. I'm a good enough feminist. As you'll see, there are a lot of contradictions and failures in there, too. The papers we heard today, both yesterday, those in the morning session on writing the history of feminism, and in the afternoon panel on the institutionalization of feminism in the museum and the academy, were so varied in subject, material, and viewpoint that, of course, it would be impossible for me to address them all in a single 30-minute response. And I'm not going to do so. I'm just going to say that I found Anne Wagner's wonderful keynote address as a piece that really provides a paradigm, as so much of her work does, for present and future feminist practice, mixing as it did student statements, videos of older women, a paper rich in contradiction and potentiality. I thought that was an exemplary and stimulating talk. Uta Mette-Bauer, in her approach, her presentation of four theatrical spaces, particularly hit my pleasure button, whatever that may be, G-spot or otherwise, with her discussion of Joan Jonas's piece on Abby Warburg, who's a figure that I, as a feminist, have been entirely wrapped up with. I've written a sonnet sequence about him. I'm planning, in some utopian future, to write a musical drama with Abby as the hero. Imagine the mad scene. Mm. Joan Jonas's piece was an inspiration, and I was so glad to hear you talk about it in such an interesting way, and I like the others. Two, Connie Butler, of course, I can't wait to see WAC. I think that's going to be a show with major impact. And I think your whole contention that feminism's impact is the most important influence in art in the post-war period, certainly in this country, is absolutely well taken, right on. David Joslett, do images have a gender? Well, maybe yes, maybe no, but you certainly started me thinking about this. And the book on Rena Spalding is going to be required reading about Renee Smalding is going to be required reading for me and my students. Griselda, what a speech. I mean, that was, well, you're always inspirational. But I don't always agree with you as heavily as I did this time. I thought it was just a wow of a speech, a brilliant performance, a really interesting and passionate defense of a large and expansive vision of feminism. And I thank you for that speech, which really inspired me. Helen, I also found your talk very interesting. I mean, I always wonder about relations among feminist artists, how to talk about them without falling into the old mother cliché. Not that it has to be a cliché. I think of Gertrude Stein's marvelous opera, The Mother of Us All, one of the most exciting theater and music pieces. I don't know why it isn't given more often, but it's about, what's her name, famous feminist, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Oh, Susan B. Anthony, sorry. Okay, that proves it should be given more often. I would have remembered. Anyway, it's marvelous. But I still think that finding another paradigm, another system of relationships where women can find affinities with other women without always being cast into the mother-daughter role is a brilliant idea, and visually seems to me very convincing, too, though we do have to talk about sibling rivalry, too, don't we? I mean, once you get siblings, you have rivalry. I don't have any, so... Okay. Wangechi Mutu, that was a fascinating talk. You know, I like your work. Wangechi Mutu is going to be in the forthcoming show at the Brooklyn Museum. And another member of our panel discussion, Geeta Kapoor, is also presenting a wonderful essay in that catalog. So we have some, there are probably some other people here too who I can't see or didn't hear from who are going to be in that show. But I love the combination of beauty, horror, wit, and occult reference that exists in your work. So, and I thought your talking about it was really interesting and informative. And Ingrid Sissy, talking like me without a PowerPoint, I think you absolutely made your point without PowerPoint, let's say, with radio as a kind of metaphor. I think we stop thinking of how important radio can be and all the possibilities that it offers. Radio, where you can use your visual imagination without having to look at the ghastly things you see on television, where a dropped watermelon stands for a suicide. I grew up with radio, and one of the great advantages of radio, which maybe you didn't point out, is you can read while you listen to the radio, which I always found wonderful. Now, all of these talks, I think, bear witness to the fact that feminism in the visual arts seems to be alive and flourishing in the present and not so distant future. First of all, there's the event we're at right now, the hottest ticket in town, and at MoMA, not hitherto prominent as a site of feminist activism, except for some memorable protests that some of us mentioned in the 70s. Indeed, an earlier feminist, Carol Duncan, went so far as to characterize the plethora of modernist nudes on offer at the Museum of Modern Art as MoMA's Red Hot Mamas, if I remember the title correctly. But of course, times have changed, and now gender studies and women artists, not of course identical with feminism, but close enough, are part of most university curricula, and one woman or group shows of women artists are more or less de rigueur, both here and in Europe, in galleries and museums. MoMA has come a long way, baby. Two major shows devoted not merely to women artists, but to feminism as a project are in the offing, which you've heard about both. WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, opening at the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA on March 4th, celebrating and revisiting the achievements of the women artists involved in the women's art movement of the 70s, the inception of a self-conscious, coordinated feminist art, and of course, global feminisms at the Brooklyn Museum's Feminist Art Center, the Sackler Center, the only such museum entity, I believe, in the world, presenting the work of younger women artists from all over the world and in all media, with emphasis on the work of women from non-Western nations and positions. And that's curated, of course, by Maura Riley, who's the head of that operation, and myself. In addition, an important new book on contemporary women artists after the revolution, edited by a group of women art critics, with articles by Eleanor Hartney, Helene Posner, Nancy Princethal, and Sue Scott on such prominent women artists as Louise Bourgeois, Nancy Spiro, Elizabeth Murray, Marina Abramovich, Cindy Sherman, Sharon Neshat, is about to appear. And later in the year, the Tate Museum is planning a major retrospective of the work of Louise Bourgeois, a woman artist with full feminist credentials. Surely, it would seem that feminism in the visual arts is alive and well, despite rumors to the contrary, and that all this should be a cause for unmitigated rejoicing among feminist historians and critics like myself. Well, yes and no. Or rather, the rejoicing must be mixed with a certain skepticism, or at least a problematizing of the situation of women artists and feminist criticism. Such is the position of Carol Armstrong in her Art Forum preview of the two feminist shows I mentioned above. Says Armstrong, quote, "I applaud their focus on art by women and recognize that the MoCA show's self-prescribed targeting of second wave feminism is historically justified in this regard. But I am leery of a correspondence that may be set up between women's art and feminist art, for it suggests first that only women can be feminists, and second, that women artists must be concerned with feminist themes, which must in turn be women's themes. That," she continues, "would be a double disservice to both women and feminists, a proclamation that feminism is only of interest to women and that women are a class apart from the human. Surely," she says, "the feminist revolution has shown us the fallacy of both ideas. So it is to be hoped that WAC and global feminisms will provide openings toward a future in which male artists may be feminists and female artists may concern themselves with whatever engages them," end quote. Now, certainly, one hopes for a future in which male artists can be feminists. So far, however, I have not seen too much evidence, though there is some, of male feminism, despite the fact that feminist art practice has had and continues to have a profound influence on the shape of art since the 70s. Nor do I think that most women artists engaged with feminism by any means think that, quote, "women are a class apart from the human," end quote. On the contrary, it is the misogynists of the world who propagate such a belief. And certainly, women artists should be and are free to explore whatever dimensions of art and experience they wish to. Often, in my opinion, the most interesting feminist practice is not consciously or intentionally political, but speaks out subtly, humorously, originally, sardonically, of critical gender issues from different frames of reference. I cannot imagine forcing some cliched, boring, politically correct agenda on a woman artist any more than I would do so with a male artist. More worrisome to me is the institutionalization of feminist practice and theory within the museum and the university. A triumph, to be sure, but like many triumphs, a mixed blessing. What does the institutionalization of feminist practice and theory imply? What does the substitution of gender studies for feminist studies imply? Is it the neutralization of feminist critique into a kind of even-handed study of chosen artists, like the analysis of 19th century, quote, great male painters in books like Charles Harrison's intelligent but infuriatingly revisionist Painting the Difference, Sex and Spectator in Modern Art, actually an excuse to rescue certain exceptional works by exceptional male artists from the putative clutches of feminist critique? Of course, feminist art historians have, for the most part, never totally rejected Manet, Degas, or Cézanne, as Harrison implies. On the contrary, they have revivified them and the study of 19th century art in general by showing them in a new light, revealing formal and expressive qualities and theoretical models, good and bad, never considered before feminist art history brought them to light. What happens when feminism becomes a course rather than a cause? When gender studies are institutionalized as simply another item in the curriculum? And what happens, on the contrary, within institutional settings, either museum or university, when feminist critique is abandoned in favor of an uncritical celebration of women artists and their work in shows or courses devoted to the subject? Or when token women are inserted into the world art canon? Or when essentialism creeps into what I profoundly believe must always be considered the social construction of the entity woman? One is not born, one becomes a woman, declared Simone de Beauvoir. Still, excuse me for using the phrase, the mother of us all, theoretically speaking. Essentialism, like all such mythologies, may be good for the creation of art as a mythology. It is not good for thinking about art or artists, especially women. Many years ago, a philosopher, now forgotten, Sue Larson, wrote a great, if now totally neglected, article entitled, What Befits a Woman? She concluded, nothing. In other words, that virtues, good or fitting for one sex, were always good for the other. There is no specialization of virtue. I feel that so strongly. I know that I got very angry at my dear friend who called me up to tell me about Granny's strike for peace. I found that absolutely infuriating. I said, I'm a granny to my grandchildren. If I'm going to strike for peace, and I think these women probably do wonderful work, I want to strike for peace with men. I want it to be grannies and old codgers strike for peace. And I am not going to strike for peace out of my virtue as a woman. That is something I feel very strongly about. I think women should be wary of having virtues thrust upon them, which should be common to all human beings, and that women, like men, to quote Milton's immortal phrase, should be sufficient to stand but free to fall. That's a wonderful phrase, which we should all, sufficient to stand, which means you're free, you're strong, you're empowered, but you can make the wrong choice, you can eat that apple, and look where you end up. Women are naturally kinder and gentler. Surely Abu Ghraib has shattered that fond illusion if it needed shattering. The femme fatale and the witch have always been part of high and popular iconography, along with the virtue and the innocent little girl. Women are connected with nature through their very essence. Tell that to the cosmetic industry, to the plastic surgeons, the dress designers, and diet doctors and their clients on every level of society. Women, on the contrary, if we look at the popular media, seem to be the very embodiment of artifice. And contemporary women like Cindy Sherman and Marilyn Minter, in their very different ways, mine that woman artifice nexus to its ultimate limit of grotesquery, estrangement, and visual ambiguity. Women artists naturally prefer the realm of the transient, the delicate, the small scale, the emotional. No, and certainly not all of them. Rosa Bonheur, certainly one of the most popular artists of the 19th century, asserted herself through large scale, as does Louise Bourgeois today, in her monumental spiders and room-sized cells. Both Nancy Spiro and Kiki Smith have turned to transient materials in small scale, but for specific purposes, often quite aggressive, passionate, and unexpected ones. Nevertheless, the socially constructed woman, if she is an artist, faces a different world experience and challenge than many male artists do. Difference, if always different and changing, may be said to exist. The forms that difference takes in art are obviously multiple, uncharted, and in the future, unchartable. Today, I believe that these variables are often based on national and ethnic identities, and for that reason, much of the most interesting feminist art by women is being created by women from non-Western settings. This has nothing to do with primitivism or nature, but rather with specific situations. Women artists in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Australia are in touch with the most contemporary media, sophisticated theory, and international art production, and are creating new kinds of visual languages to embody new meanings, new interpretations of the situation of women in different cultures. Complex, acerbic, vivid, contrarian, and often, dare I use that word, beautiful. In a way, one might say that for many artists worldwide, their situation as women simply cannot be avoided. One might almost speak of a feminist unconscious in the work of some of the most brilliant contemporary women artists, a critical force which has nothing to do with the woman-nature nexus or vaginal imagery, but with ambiguity, androgyny, contrarianism, rejection of the cliched categories of womanhood, experiment with the body and its metamorphoses, and exploration and exploitation of all the various media of contemporary art making. Now, as part of my response, I would like to ask a question, straightforwardly. It's been posed, but I think not completely answered. What is a feminist? How does one become a feminist, and specifically a feminist in the field of the visual arts? For an answer to this question, I will look not forward to a feminist future, but back to a feminist past, my own past, in fact, to see what I can find. If Anne Wagner can resort to divination and futurology in search of feminist futures, and I have to admit, I have a little voodoo doll that actually works. I can resort to confessional and autobiography to unlock the feminist past, which, as a good historian, I believe always contains the seeds of the future, even if it cannot happily account for the unpredictability of things or the precise form that future will take. I still remember vividly my first act of feminist critique in the realm of the visual. I must have been about 6 years old when I performed this act of desecration. Slowly, deliberately, I poked out the eyes of Tinkerbell in an expensively illustrated edition of Peter Pan with the points of a compass. I still remember my feeling of excitement as the sharp point pierced through those blue, long-lashed orbs. I hoped it hurt, and I was both frightened and triumphant, looking at the black holes in the expensive paper. I hated Tinkerbell, her weakness, her sickening sweetness, her helplessness, her wispy, evanescent body. So different from my sturdy, plump one. Her pale hair, her plea to her audience to approve of her. I was glad I destroyed her baby blues. And in fact, I was repeating, not knowing, the gesture of Mary, quote, slasher Richardson, militant suffragette who attacked the canvas of La Roca B. Venus with a meat cleaver to protest the arrest of Emmeline Pankhurst on the previous day. She explained her actions by saying, I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. And later, in an interview, she admitted that she didn't like the way men visitors gaped at Velázquez's Roca B. Venus all day long. I continued my campaign of iconoclasm with my first grade reader, Linda and Larry, it was called. And Larry was about a head taller than Linda and always the leader in whatever banal activity the two were called on to perform. See Larry run, see Linda run, see Larry run, run Linda run, etc. Larry was always at least three paces ahead of Linda and a head taller. I successfully amputated Larry's head with a blunt scissors on one page of the reader and cut off his legs on another. I do believe still that freedom to hate, to scorn and dislike is a feminist freedom. Do not imagine, as I said, that I was a precocious man-hater or boy-hater. Among my favorite books were Booth Tarkington's Penrod series, I don't know how many people still read that wonderful series, and the great Otto of the Silver Hand, written by Howard Pyle and illustrated by him with shady, Durer-esque engravings. I read Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi with its strictly male cast of characters three times in a row. What I hated was not men. My beloved grandfather was the one who most encouraged me in my intellectual and artistic pursuits, but rather the visual putting down of girls and women vis-a-vis a power situation in both high and popular culture. And I resorted to extreme measures when confronted by it. Yet, my career as an early feminist art critic was sadly or happily flawed by contradictions. At 8 or 9, I pored over my uncle's Esquire magazines, gazing enraptured at the smooth, airbrushed contours of the scantily dressed, salaciously posed Petty and Varga girls, curvy pinups with large, cup-like conical breasts and exaggerated bottoms, always wearing the highest of heels and the lowest of décolletés. I knew there was something forbidden about them, though I didn't know exactly what sex as an entity was. But it wasn't their breasts or their backsides that really got to me, but rather their feet, those preternaturally high arches, smooth, round, perfect semicircles, uplifted on towering high heels. I drew them again and again as though I could capture some of their mana by the act of drawing them, just as I drew the Vogue models in my grandmother's fashion magazines. And I noticed my taste for politically incorrect art exists to this day when I actually found in Anne's talk that I much preferred Willem de Kooning's Woman to Lee Krasner's Prophecy. I think Woman is a powerful, to me, feminist piece of art. I don't care what de Kooning's intentions were. I don't even care that it was he who did the picture, but I think that is a powerful image, brilliantly executed, and I claim it for feminism. I'm not worried about who made it and what his intentions were. At exactly the same time, and for not different reasons, I was seduced by the reproduction of Jean Fouquet's Agnes Sorel as the Virgin in our Treasury of Art Masterpieces collection. The painting of a fetish image, if ever there was one, with the worldly Queen of Heaven's bulging white breast protruding over her tightly laced bodice, her rounded bare forehead domed under an elegant spiky golden crown, and her entourage of bright scarlet angels splitting out of their tight breeches like little gods of erection. Here, too, I knew there was something forbidden. I couldn't take my eyes off that white breast, those red thighs. And this, too, was part of the education of an incipient feminist, this sexualized rotundity and expansion that I couldn't quite get a grip on, but that fascinated me in its visual expression that nobody seemed to want to talk about or explain to a little girl. In these images, images, women were depicted as powerful by male artists, to be sure, but more because of what they were than what they did, or rather, more because of how they looked than what they did. Now let's skip a decade or so and move on to college, Vassar in the late 40s after the war, when an institution with a serious feminist past, and a history of brilliant and creative students like Elizabeth Bishop and Mary McCarthy succumbed to the post-war demand that women return to Kinderkirche Küche. A well-publicized survey team of sociologists, psychologists, and education authorities, known as the Mellon Committee, blighted the ambition of women students as well as women's potential for achievement by declaring the college a homosexual matriarchy and declaring women who dared to use their minds in competition with men as, quote, overachievers. Needless to say, I was in that group. Yet here again, contradiction fortunately abided. In the classroom, in our courses, by our teachers, the better ones, male and female, we were encouraged to strive, to excel, to explore, even if nothing much awaited us after graduation but marriage, parenthood, and membership in the Junior League of St. Louis or Scranton. In my junior year social psych course, I decided to do, for a term paper, a so-called content analysis of the women's magazines of the period, thereby enabling myself to read in good conscience what I usually felt guilty about as time-wasting. Parenthetically, I must admit that then, as now, this feminist enjoys the occasional wallow in the sluttish pleasures of popular culture. Us, In Touch, OK, Star. I don't buy them, but if they're around like Vogue or Elle or Allure, I will certainly flip through them, by no means entirely uncritically, but with a certain delicious clandestine enjoyment. What was interesting about my content analysis of the women's magazines of the late 40s was the double message they handed out to their readers. On the one hand, there were the serious articles about major women activists and achievers like Eleanor Roosevelt or Dorothy Thompson or Amelia Earhart, presumably calculated to encourage their readership to do likewise. But the fiction they offered up for female consumption told an entirely different story. In all cases, without exception, in the stories in the women's magazines, women who pursued careers, who didn't pay full-time attention to husbands and children and domestic affairs, were doomed and punished. Career girls who wanted to keep on working, women artists or writers who dared to compete with male partners, were cast into outer darkness. Either they remained old maids, or they lost their mates to more properly domesticated women. The message was clear, and because it was cast in the guise of fiction, appealed more to the emotions or even the unconscious fears and doubts and desires of the female audience at stake. Such fiction reinforced the doxa of the day, and no doubt helped sell more houses, more washing machines, and more table linen to the would-be model housewives and helpmeets these magazines catered to. It also opened my eyes to my still hypothetical future. Though not yet a card-carrying feminist, and who was in those days, besides some shapeless, tweedy old leftover suffragettes among the emeriti, I knew from that time onward that I was not going to be one of those model domestic women. I despised them and vowed inwardly that I would be different. Of course, there were other models for heterosexual women on view at a university, bohemian wives and mothers, or in rare cases, married female instructors, but their fate was almost too awful to contemplate. Trying to finish their dissertations, write their poetry, or paint their pictures amid a shambles of urine-soaked diapers, unwashed dishes, and uncontrollable children. No thanks. But still, my friends, a few of them and I, were isolated and confused in attempting to stake out a meaningful, proto-feminist, as it were, future. It was not until 1969 and the mass impulsion of the Women's Liberation Movement with its sub-organization in art, the Women's Art Movement, that my feminist impulses assumed coherent, coordinated, and eventually an institutional formulation, both activist and theoretical. To those of you who have read my piece, Starting from Scratch, in the excellent anthology edited by Norma Browdy and Mary Garrard called The Power of Feminist Art, I recommend that you do so, because it's hard to believe in 2007 either the situation of ambitious women like myself or the obstacles, institutional, theoretical, and self-imposed, that stood in our way. In that article, I describe my reading of the early texts of the Women's Liberation Movement, Off Our Backs, Red Stockings Newsletter, the one that we talked about yesterday that was discussed, as a kind of epiphany that I experienced like Paul on the road to Damascus, waking me up to a new light of knowledge and the power of communal action. Women artists formed groups to show their work and to talk about it. Women academics formed consciousness-raising sessions and changed the subjects of their classes to include feminist material. No matter how individual we were or wanted to be as women, it was clear that power and change lay in group activity. Women artists included, have always historically garnered major attention by being exceptions. Women like Madame Vigée Le Brun in the 18th century as a specifically female portrait painter, Rosa Bonheur in the 19th century as being a woman animalier, Georgia O'Keeffe, without any doubt one of the best known modern artists in the United States with a plethora of calendar covers and notepads to prove it, as a modernist in the 20th century. But not until the women's movement of the 70s, and that of the present day, I might add, was there an attempt, and at least a partly successful one, to reframe and recast the whole conception of who an artist was, and to insist that women artists, like women generally, were not merely part of the human race rather than apart from it, but an integral element of that entity, artist, and all it implies. Women artists are no longer exceptions, brilliant or not, but part of the rule. That is the point to me of the feminist project, and a point which still needs to be made today in many parts of the world, where the feminist struggle is still going on many levels. And it is for that reason that shows of women artists, courses disseminating the feminist critique of art, and understanding and appreciation of the many directions, the many kinds of imagination, creative invention, and critical intelligence of women need to be encouraged and rewarded today as in the feminist future. Of course, feminist artists and critics in the feminist future should be free to criticize and make judgments about women artists and writers, rather than condescending to them by refraining from value judgments. Unconditional praise is always suspect. I speak as a feminist, riven by contradiction, a condition I hope that future feminists can cope with. As I have, as I think we must. I am the most aesthetic of creature. My appetite for high art is unappeasable. When I think of the Velasquez show in London that I went with two feminist friends, my heart beats faster. No, I and my feminist friends did not bring axes to the show. Rather, looking at the miraculous squiggles of white edged paint close up, I thought of Eva Hess. When I had myself painted into Manet's Bar at the Folie Bergère by feminist artist Kathleen Gilly, it was because I wanted to be there at the heart of the painting, looking out of it at the same time being in it, a fantasy come true. I play or listen to the work of Johann Sebastian Bach at least 2 hours every day and write Spenserian sonnets and sapphic odes for relaxation. But of course, I drown myself in TV detective shows at night and love nice clothes, playing with my cats and having silly fun with my friends at parties. Why shouldn't feminists do these things? And I think we all do. Being a feminist, though, an abiding concern, is not a full-time occupation. But my passion for justice for women is perhaps my strongest passion of all, and the longest-lasting one. And that, I think, is what basically characterizes feminism and the feminist project in the past, now, and in the future. Justice for women, all women, everywhere. I do not feel obliged to love all women, to like them, or even to know them. But I do feel obligated, within a more restricted domain, to support and speak out for the feminist, mostly women artists I like or who rouse my interest, and to teach and disseminate the work of women art historians, art critics, and theorists, even those whom I violently disagree with. that other people, mostly women, but some men, continue this project is my hope for a feminist future. Thank you.
Sure. Linda, I'd like to thank you for expressing how I feel too about this conference. My name is Blake Gopnik. I'm an art critic. I found it really transformative in all sorts of ways. And one of the things that made me realize is how incredibly important it was to myself to have been raised by a woman who declared herself a ball-breaking feminist and still does, raised with four sisters who all declare themselves to be ball-breaking feminists and are all active in that, to be married to an artist who declares herself a ball-breaking feminist artist. And my copy is certainly improved by having it read by a ball-breaking feminist artist before it ever even gets to my editors at my newspaper. But I want to thank you especially for bringing something up that I was worried wasn't going to be brought up enough, except by, in fact, two men who participated in this, which is the possibility of, more than the possibility, the crucial need for male feminists. One of the things that struck me is that when we were talking a few minutes ago about the problem of women in careers and child-rearing, the crucial problem is that men don't have a problem. Men with children don't have a problem with child-rearing and their careers. Until that changes, until men feel that they, in fact, are as deeply involved in all those issues as women, the situation for women won't change. One of the things that shocks me most about this meeting is not an exclusion, but a self-exclusion of men at this meeting. There was nothing to stop, you know, hundreds of men from buying tickets, but they clearly didn't feel that it was necessary to buy tickets, necessary to be here. If Glenn Lowry couldn't make it because he was in Europe, there are priorities to everything. If this had been a gathering of 600 of the most important collectors in the country, he would have been here. Had it been the 600 most important dealers, he would have been here. Until men feel feminism is necessary to themselves, I'm afraid that feminism will have a much harder time making an impact in society. That's 50% of people with 90% of the power who, for whatever reason, don't feel that feminism should or needs to touch them.
Great. I have nothing to answer because I I thoroughly agree with you. But I might also add one thing, which is that so many men don't know what they're missing. They really don't. You know, I mean, it's not just a burden to raise a child. It's a lot of fun. They're like pussycats, you know? I mean, they're marvelous. And in very serious ways, it gives one deep satisfaction to engage in child rearing. It's not just dirty diapers and so on. It's a pleasure, pleasurable. Those dear little skins, I mean, they're just yummy. So I think men are missing a hell of a lot, you know? I mean, having to be in dirty, boring old offices all day long and not having the pleasure. And, you know, somebody has to knock it into the heads of men that it's something they're missing that they really should get a hold of. Hmm? Okay.
Well, I think men will be educated on many levels from this conference, and whether you're among the older generation or the younger generation here, I think that what is pivotal in the discussions over the past 2 days is that the discourse on feminism is a work in progress, evolving and interactive. And we'll really look forward to WAC and the Brooklyn Show and an exhibition that will happen at Brandeis University of Contemporary Women Artists from India that Geeta right. Kapoor is advising us on, because we are learning in the global spectrum. And that exhibition will be called New Art from India, Women Daring to Transform Society. But I really want to say that I think Abby Aldrich Rockefeller would be so proud, even though it is 2007 and this conference is happening, that it is happening here. And I think it is a tribute to your leadership and all of the bright women here who have given us the strength. And it really is the wisdom of this collected audience that will take it forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm gonna try to be right to the point. Thank you everyone for everything today. I just felt compelled to get up here and say, with all of this rich conversation about defining feminism and thinking about history, what strikes me is that feminism was not invented in the 1970s. The evolution and the beginning of feminism in this country really begins in the 19-teens. And women do, and some men, self-identify as feminists in the 19-teens, and I think would be really fascinating for art historians to look at the kind of conversations between that first movement in this country and the 1970s movement. And let's not forget that there was a movement in the 19-teens. And the research that I've done is just amazing, the virulent anti-feminism in the 19-teens, it could be written today, so that it's circular. So let's really expand our notion of history.
I utterly agree, and I'm a historian, and I study the 19th century, and there's 18th century feminism too, so you know, you can really take it back quite a way. Yes.
I wanted to thank everyone here for making a sacred space in which there could be real open thinking. And I wanted to thank you for making me laugh instead of being sad about leaving the space. And I think we should put you on Comedy Central as a fundraiser. But one of the things I wanted to address briefly here is that there hasn't been very much space made for ecological art. And that is a direction that feminists who are interested in the environment, artists, have gone dramatically. And it's very hard to fit it into a museum space. I just want to briefly name a few of the people. Navjot Altuf was already mentioned. Dominique Maigzot, Beverly Nidus, Susan Steinman, Shai Zakai, myself. It goes on and on and on and on. And I wonder to what extent people like that were considered for the upcoming shows.
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I never thought of that as a separate category. I mean, maybe there were some, or are some, so ecological artists included. But I never thought that it necessarily connected with feminism. I think a lot of people are ecologically conscious and so on. I'm afraid I'm not one of them. I should be. I realize this is a flaw, but I rarely look out at nature. I'm too busy looking in the shop windows, I think. I just don't know enough about it. I'm not putting it down. I think it's an extremely worthy movement, but I'm glad you informed me about it because now I'm going to think about it a little more. Thank you.
I just wanted to bring up something that keeps coming up for me when we talk about the term feminist and the concern about it and the hand-wringing. You can't hear me. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
The concern about that term reminds me of some of the concern about the term liberal and what's been done to that. And I think that inherent in both, there's this propensity to allow our inner differences and the diversity that's part of the strength of these movements to keep us from being able to give a coherent positive definition out there to the world. And then it allows other people to co-opt that definition. And I wonder, we hear so many critiques even in this shared sacred space, trying to really self-critique, and yet is there the possibility out of this, do you think, for finding a positive, coherent thing that we could all agree on that would counter the negative, man-hating thing that I think the pop culture was able to get out there much more solidly than we are able to get out our own message?
Well, I think that oversimplified negative definitions always have a big advantage over complex positive definitions. And I think we aren't going to avoid it by having some pop phrase like, you know, feminism for femmes or something like that. I don't know, what I'm just making up something. I mean, I think it is when I say that what I see as feminism is justice for women worldwide and in every area. That's what I mean by feminism. And it's fairly simple, and I think a lot of people can agree about it, but obviously it's not very nuanced and it's not very descriptive of all the entities and complexities that might constitute such justice. But some aspects of it are pretty clear. So, I mean, that's a beginning place. I think most people could agree on that as a kind of basic definition and then go on from there. But I agree that it's a problem. It's a problem. It's not easy.
Hi. I'm Elizabeth Tremonti, and thank you so much for a wonderful talk. I have a question, and I ask it in very good humor, about what you called violent disagreement. I'm part of a women's artist collective in Los Angeles, and the first time that we had a major argument while working on a project, I was absolutely mortified. I thought it was the end. And over time, I've come to see that this is a way of working. And also over time, many people, both men and women, have asked in a very titillating tone, so do you fight? And, you know, we've, I think, all come to answer that question only if there's a pit of mud nearby that we can jump into. So I'm really interested in maybe hearing some comments on fighting and disagreement, and not just through dialogue, but really combat, maybe the theater or the pleasure in that with regards to feminism.
Well, physical combat, I'm afraid.
I don't mean physical.
Yeah, maybe a kind of fun wrestling match with some cute guy might be nice. But, no, but to be serious, I think women are very often trained not to fight. I mean, I was always amazed, you know, to see how boys actually would get down to physical fighting, whereas women sometimes nagged each other and said mean things to each other or shunned each other or things like that. And when I got older, I was also interested. I was at one point working with a group of men on a hypothetical history of art that never came to anything. But I was very interested to see how men would just insult, what seemed to me like insult each other and say very critical things to each other and get into heated arguments and fight back. And in the end, you know, they go out for a drink. I mean, it was not like, oh, my gosh, et cetera. Nothing like that. And I thought, you know, I am going to learn from men a little because I tended to be in the, you know, that school. And I set myself to learning from men. You know, what do they do? I noticed how a relative of mine treated his wife. He was very smart, and she was smart, but she wasn't as educated. And they'd have a fight, and he'd just get quieter and quieter, and she would get more and more hysterical and say irrational things and so on. And it would end in tears, and she would leave the room, and he'd sort of look, you know, isn't this awful? I mean, yeah. So I tried that at a public meeting with some men. And I just remained silent. And sure enough, it worked like a charm. And this very macho guy kept getting angry. And he was getting furious. And finally I said, oh, Al, I said, try not to be hysterical. And I saw what the strategy was. And it was a strategy. And it's a strategy that the business world, I suppose, you know, people are trained for in some way. And I think positive anger can be very useful and is sometimes necessary, and sometimes one just can't help it. It's when anger gets over the top and control is lost and it's no longer functional. I also learned in France how to be functionally angry. Monsieur, get down, you slap your umbrella up and down, say monsieur a few times, and monsieur, he replies. There are modes of anger that are useful and productive and that, you know, if women don't know them yet, they better get onto it. Okay, I think that's what I mean. And can I have some water if anyone has some? Thanks.
Hi, thank you. I really appreciated the multidimensionality you presented of ideas of being a feminist and what it means to be a feminist, and with including all of its possible contradictions. I also appreciated your talking of the social construction of gender, and also appreciating Griselda's talk, because what it seemed like what she was talking about was not only focusing on that. And I wonder what that space is in between, and you know, without obviously being able to repeat everything that she said and that you said, but sort of what is that space where we can learn from not only looking at it as social construction, and at the same time, am I making
sense? No, you're making perfect sense, because I do think Griselda and I disagree on this. I mean, that's one of the cases where we have different views, and I think Griselda's viewpoint, I always listen very attentively, you know, and I who knows, I might change my mind at some point. It's perfectly possible, because I think she argues the case so well and so richly and so subtly, but I think those are two different viewpoints, and I'm not sure that we agree on that score, though we may agree on a great many other things.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Mary Beth Edelson here. I don't have a question for Linda. I just had a couple of quick practical comments I wanted to make. One of them is that one is about race and one is about access. One of the tenets of the feminist movement is to have equal access to everything, like having equal access to this conference, I think, has been difficult for some people to get in, to know when it was going to happen, and to know about it, because it was sold out so early. And
also, we don't have equal access to who is here, and if we want to continue the dialogue, to have equal access to those who want to share their email numbers or share being on a mailing list so that there's some kind of continuation of this dialogue. So that kind of very practical nuts and bolts access. And then the other thing I wanted to just comment on briefly is race. And my viewpoint about that, not only is race an institutional responsibility and how we interact with people of different colors from ourselves, but it is an individual responsibility. And I think when it's taken on as an individual responsibility, that each of us comes to a meeting, comes to a situation, having contacted someone of another color to come with us, or to find out if they've had equal access, and when they do come, to make sure that they are feeling welcomed, that we are extremely, that we go out of our way to be more hospitable to these people, because they are not necessarily going to be, feel comfortable in a situation where there's so many of us who have known each other generation after generation. So you have to go out of your way for that. So I just wanted to make those two comments. Thank you.
Okay.
Åsa Sonjasdotter is my name. I'm from Scandinavia. Very happy to be here. This is just like a little comment or maybe a, like suggestion for the next seminar. We have like the subtitles for today, Writing the History of Feminism and Institutionalization of Feminism. And I could see Griselda Pollock had some images from an exhibition in Sweden that is like a similar one to the one coming in Los Angeles soon. And I think there's always a little bit of a problem when institutions, which is, I mean, it's very nice that they do, but they often have a little bit of a problem to pick up such dynamic movements as the feminist movement, because institutions very often have this link to collections and collecting and commodification. And it has always struck me, I mean, now I come from Scandinavia, and in Scandinavia we have like federal money for art institutions. And it has always struck me that if you are like a curator in such an institution, you would have the freedom to really work and to try to define and to develop new models for exhibitions and how to use the spaces. And it seems to me that the market still is so dominant that even these institutions that have federal money first, I mean, like pick artists through galleries very often. Like they don't so very often just go out and research on the artist networks and the self-organized artists. And therefore, I just wanted to suggest that maybe for the coming seminar, it could be interesting to talk about titles as Feministification of Writing the History, or to have a subtitle called Feministification of Institutions. Because I think that would be a very nice challenge to see what happened. Thank you very much.
Okay.